Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Here's what we're going to do tonight. We've been talking about Passover, no surprise there. We've been talking about Passover now for several weeks. And so it's inevitable that we are going to reach the point of having to talk about the Lord's Supper and how the Lord's Supper ought to be taken and the frequency of the Lord's Supper, which is a big topic around here because here at GCA, we typically take the Lord's Supper once a year. And we do it in correspondence with the Passover season, and we do it on our homecoming weekend on Resurrection Sunday. And that was one of the most controversial decisions I ever made. And I have, through the years, had many, many conversations about it, and many discussions about it, and lots of email about it, and I've written several Q&As about it, including the most recent one called The Frequency of Communion, which is now up on the website as a downloadable PDF. I have a copy of it here. I'll be reading from some of it tonight for two reasons. Number one, I like reading from authors I agree with, and so that's good. And then also, you know, my philosophy is there's nothing more fun than listening to Jim read. But I'm going to go through as much of it just extemporaneously as I possibly can. We won't get probably to 1 Corinthians tonight. I expect to get there next week. But this week, I just want to talk primarily about the early church, the New Testament church, and how often, how frequently we can say they did take communion from Scripture. Because there are common, and when I say common, I mean almost universal arguments among the groups that take communion weekly or monthly, and I've read all the books. I think I can say, without too much fear of contradiction, that in my effort to tell the truth about the Bible and my absolute conviction to get to the truth of these things, everybody here knows that, like when we did the series on spiritual gifts, I had gone into that series because for years I've been a strict cessationist, that the spiritual gifts were done with. And then Jeff one day challenged me and said, "Can you prove that biblically, though? You know, you're Mr. I don't have any business saying it if I can't prove it with the Bible. Can you prove that?" And so I started reading and reading and came away with the, "Oh, no, I can't. Oh, my goodness." So we taught the series on spiritual gifts and came to the conclusion, a conclusion, that was actually different than everything I had believed up until actually having to piece that all together. So my point in saying that is I think you all know that I have a history of being willing to change my view. If I can find a convincing argument, I love rigorous arguments, and I love inescapable conclusions. I love being backed into a corner theologically where there's no answer except this one. That's a great place to be. The reason I accepted God's election before the foundation of the world is because I reached the point where I said, it's got to be that way. I'm stuck with that. I can't go anywhere else. So I'm perfectly willing to change my view if necessary. And so I've been reading and reading and reading and reading over the last several months, re-examining all of my foundational rationales and reasoning for once a year communion. And I feel very much like I felt when I was out in Franklin and the pastor out there and knowing that I was premillennial and also knowing that I had been very impressed with Lorraine Bettner's book on the Reformed Doctrine of Predestination, he then gave me Lorraine Bettner's book on postmillennialism, big thick book, you know, and said, "Here, read this. This will convince you." And so I took it home and read it thoroughly, took it back and handed it to him. And he said, "Well, did it convince you?" And I said, "Absolutely. I am convinced I'm right." Because this book, as big and thick and heavy as it was, didn't provide the argument that would make me go, "Ah, you know, I got to change my view here." And that's kind of how I feel right now. I've gotten to the end of literally months of reading and studying and going through all this to see if I could convince myself that the once a year approach was wrong. And what I've come away with is an even more firm conviction that actually, biblically, it's the only defensible way to take communion. Now, having said that, I'm not trying to pick fights with anybody. And I'm not stumping that every church that does it any other way is wrong. I assume that they are following the dictates of their own conscience, and I leave that between them and God. But I can only comfortably engage myself and this church in those things that I can say, this is biblically defensible. So tonight we're going to look at the most common arguments and the passages for once a week or once a month communion. And we're going to talk about whether they hold water. And I've been thinking about how to best do that. How do we best make this argument? And I decided the way to do it is to start in Matthew 11. So turn there. Matthew 11 has nothing to do with communion.
Oh, I get it.
Matthew 11:11. Jesus speaking. Red letter words, very important words. Now I have heard this verse preached the same way many, many times in my life. And when I was out in Franklin, there was a standard interpretation of this verse. And just the other day on the radio, I heard that exact same interpretation of this verse presented the same way. So we're going to read the verse, and then I'm going to present to you the standard interpretation of this verse. And then we're going to talk about whether the interpretation I presented to you was valid or not, and why or why not. Once we've reached that point, we can go talk about the communion verses. But first we have to put some rules in place. And the best way to put the rules in place is by example. Everybody with me? Come on, play the game with me. Come on. Okay. Truly I say to you, this is Jesus speaking, among those born of women, there is not arisen anyone greater than John the Baptist, and yet he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. Verse 12 is the verse I really want to concentrate on. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. Let me tell you what that verse means. It means that we have to be willing to pray with a holy violence. We have to be willing to approach heaven with that kind of taking it by force attitude where nothing less than what we desire is going to be good enough. We're not going to settle for anything other than the response we're looking for to our prayer. We have to be willing to storm the gates of heaven with our prayer life. If your prayer life is any less than the willingness to go to heaven and storm it and take it violently, if you're not willing to do that, then your prayer life is, in fact, below what it should be, and you're probably missing out on blessings that God in heaven are perfectly willing to give you if you would just be willing to pray, shaking the gates of heaven, and not take any less than that prayer. When Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take the kingdom by force, he was saying you have to commit yourself to getting a hold of heaven and taking it by force. That's what that verse means. You don't agree with that? By the way, has anybody ever heard that before? Yeah, very common, right? I said it was the common interpretation of the verse. Okay, so let's talk about how many things I just did wrong. Because there were a lot of them. The first and most dramatic one was that I completely ignored the context. The context is about John the Baptist being in prison. And then they've come to Jesus, John's disciples have, and they've said to him, John wants to know, are you the one, or should we look for someone else? And then he says to the audience, he starts talking to them about John, and says, when you went out to the wilderness to see John, what did you expect to go see? Did you expect to see a man in fine raiment? He said, what did you really go to see? Did you go to see a prophet? That's what you went to see. And I tell you, you saw more than a prophet. And of the kingdom of all the men born of women, you know, there's not a greater than John in the kingdom of heaven. That's the context. And yet we're supposed to believe that suddenly, in the midst of that speech about John the Baptist, Jesus suddenly launched into prayer. The next thing I did wrong is that I imposed the concept of prayer onto that verse. That verse doesn't say the word pray or prayer anywhere in it. And yet we all raised our hand and said, yes, we've heard it preached that way. Usually, the way they'll handle the verse is that they're really preaching about prayer, and in the midst of preaching about prayer, they'll just introduce that half a verse and that concept and just say, and when we pray, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force, and off they go. But there's nothing in that verse that says pray or prayer. I imported that idea into the text, and then I assumed it. And this is one of the problems with preachers who are unassailable, unquestionable, is that they get to do that. They get to just impose a concept, assume a concept into a passage, and then talk about it as if it's a given, like I just did. I didn't give you any exegetical reason why this verse was about prayer. I just told you it was and started talking. Of course, the third thing that's wrong with that interpretation is that if that's the correct and valid interpretation, it would be the only place in the Bible where Christians are referred to as the violent. Well, that would be a big problem, right? And the violent take it by force. So
you're also putting it in our hands to do the thing, and really God's the one in control.
Sure, yeah. There were a whole lot of things wrong, but I really want to emphasize that what I did was take a concept that is not technically or exegetically in the verse. I assumed it into the verse, and then having assumed it into the verse, I just moved forward as if it was a given, that it simply exists. It's here. Run with it. In this context, it was real obvious. We all went, no, Jim, you're wrong. Except that that is exactly the technique that is used by every single writer of every single book and article about weekly or monthly communion. And check me out. Go read. I've done the groundwork for you. But go read and you'll find that they all refer to the same two texts out of the book of Acts, and in both of them, they assume that it's talking about communion. So now, with that example out of the way, so you understand how not to do it, let's go look at a couple of texts.
Pastor Jim?
Yes, ma'am.
The verse we just read, what is the context then?
Okay. You're right that I should have actually explained that verse instead of going on leaving everybody with, that's the wrong one. Bye now. So the right understanding of that verse is determined by the beginning of the chapter. The beginning of the chapter is John's in prison. And yet Jesus has to explain to everybody how it is that this guy who is a prophet, who he's even going to say is the fulfillment of the prophecy that Elijah would come and pave the way for the Messiah, this is him, but where is he right now? He's in prison. So now Jesus has to explain, well then, is the kingdom of God not effective? Can the governments of men overthrow the kingdom of God? Because they've taken the prophet, they've put him in jail, and Jesus knows that he himself is going to end up on a cross. So his explanation is, from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. He's referring to the fact that John was taken by King Herod, put into prison, is going to have his head cut off, and in that way, the violent, which is the world, take the kingdom of heaven by force, and they violently abuse it.
So they're talking about John the Baptist in this context.
It's all about John the Baptist. It was about John the Baptist to begin with, and it's still about John the Baptist. The whole context is about John the Baptist.
Okay, I see.
A good way to know whether a person's interpretation of a verse is valid is try to state their interpretation in a sentence or two, and then go back and read the context and put that interpretation into the text and see if it does any damage to the flow of the text. In which case you would have, truly I say to you, that among the men that were born to women, there is not arisen one greater than John the Baptist. Yet he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, you have to pray hard enough to bring down from heaven the things you are praying for. Verse 13, for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. Right? And you go, what was that? Does somebody have an aneurysm in the middle of that passage? What just happened? We just suddenly took this really weird left turn for half a verse and then went back to talking about John again. Well, that shows you that the context is all about John. Well, if the context is all about John, then in what way can Jesus say the kingdom of heaven suffers violence? John is a perfect example. He's been taken by the violent, put into prison, and he's going to have his head cut off. That's pretty darn violent.
Okay.
Right? And Jesus is going to be beaten and spit on, scourged, mocked, nailed to a piece of wood. Pretty violent. So Jesus is assuring his followers that this is part of God's plan. This is not an aberration. This is not proof that the kingdom of heaven is failing. God has ordained that the violent were going to take the kingdom of heaven by force. And that does absolutely no damage to the context. Better deal. Turn over to Acts 2. But that's what happens when preachers get caught up in the art of preaching. I am a great big fan of preaching. I like preaching. But preaching can become an end unto itself. I'll try to give you a good example. Think Rod Parsley. Anybody know who that is? Okay, when you turn on the TV and you watch him, there's not a lot of content going on. There's a lot of hooping and hollering going on. There's a lot of stuff going on. And there's a lot of him making big, grandiose pronouncements. And there's a lot of huffing and puffing into the microphone. So there's a whole showmanship aspect going on. And once people are wrapped up in that and swept away in the emotion of it, and the whole room is rocking and reeling with it, Rod can say literally anything. And everybody will hoop and holler, "This is the year that God's going to free you from all your debt and all your..." And they're, "Whoa, I'm so happy to hear it." You know, earlier this year, he was saying it's his 50th birthday, and that made this the year of Jubilee, because it was Rod's personal 50th birthday. And since the year of Jubilee was when everything in Israel went back to its original owner, God was going to free you from your debts and give you back all the things he took away, and your kids were going to come home, and your unsaved loved ones were going to get saved, and all this kind of stuff. And people were hooting, hollering, "Yoo!" because you get caught up in the exercise of preaching. I don't do that. I am a big fan of exegesis, teaching the Bible for what it actually says. And if what it actually says rubs up against my tradition, then either the Bible's wrong or my tradition's wrong. And we have to be willing to do the very difficult work of questioning our traditions, checking our traditions, and then appropriately changing our traditions in order to bring them into conformity with what the Bible does say. And that's a tough thing to do, but it's what we're supposed to do.
Jim, we could really stand a year of Jubilee. Couldn't you turn 50, please?
Yeah. I already did 2 years ago. Did anything good happen for you?
Yeah. I wasn't here. I missed it.
You missed it. Well, like all the preachers at the beginning of 2008, did their 2008 is the number of new beginnings. 2008 is the new beginnings year, and so God is going to start with new beginnings with you. And then, you know, he's going to get you out of debt, and he's going to bring back your loved ones, all your, you know, all that stuff's going to happen because it's new beginnings. As if the Greco-Roman Julian calendar we live on is the calendar that God is also working off of, yeah. And that he was just sitting around wanting to do things, but it wasn't 2008 yet. And then when 2008 got here, hot dog, you know, he could get busy and do some stuff. So, you'll find that in the book of Jim, chapter 3, verse 8. And God said, "Hot dog." So, question: my church used to hold communion services once a month on the first Sunday of each month. I know that some other churches take communion every week. That seems to me to be what the majority of churches are doing, either once a month or once a week. Are you saying they are all wrong? To which Jim answers, "First off, grace, 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 grace. I assume that most believing church bodies engage their worship services with great sincerity. The best likelihood is that they've continued the traditions that were handed to them, and they have grown to love and invest themselves in those rituals. I'm not trying to change the whole church world. I am primarily striving to bring my own convictions and practices in line with what I am convinced the Bible teaches. Others may, and often do, disagree. This is a topic that engenders a wide range of interpretation and argumentation. Most writers assume that the church has a great deal of latitude when it comes to the frequency of communion, and they base their assumption on one of two arguments. Either they say, number one, that the Bible is essentially silent on the topic, and therefore it's left up to the individual denomination or congregation to decide what they'd like to do. Or, number two, they argue from a brief set of proof texts that the first century church observed the ordinance every Sunday. To argument number one, I would reply that the Bible is far from silent on the subject. But the language that the Bible uses has been obscured by a combination of playing down the significance of the Old Testament teaching on feasts and covenants and the constant repetition of deeply entrenched routines without the necessary and appropriate examination and correction. With that said, let's turn our attention to argument number two. In book after book, article after article, defending the weekly or monthly communion service, the same arguments based on the same reading of the same text in the same book of Acts are repeated over and over again. The first one is Acts 2:42, where it says, "And they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer." That verse, taken from its context, all by itself, is used in a multiplicity of books that I can't begin to describe to you. And as soon as it is quoted, the assumption that goes with it is that the phrase breaking bread means Lord's Supper. And so they say, well, look, the first century church right here were continually devoting themselves to these things. The apostles' teaching, so the teaching is important, and to fellowship, so getting together as a church, fellowshipping is important, and to the Lord's Supper. And from that point forward, they say, and to the Lord's Supper, and to the Lord's Supper. Because they assume that breaking bread in that verse means Lord's Supper. Now, when you're cursed with a mind like mine, you say, well, then we have to test that. Because we've just assumed something about the text that the text doesn't say. The text says breaking bread. And so we have to ask, well, then how does Luke, in particular as a writer, and then the New Testament writers as a group, how do they collectively use the phrase breaking bread? Do they use it other places? The answer is yes. And when they use it in other places, how is it used? In the majority of instances, can it be read as taking the Lord's Supper? Turns out the answer is no. It turns out that the vast majority of the time that the term is used, it has to do with anything but the Lord's Supper. It has to do with eating a meal. And Luke is going to use the phrase breaking bread on several different occasions. We're going to look at them tonight. And on some of those occasions, it's going to be impossible to conclude that Luke means Lord's Supper. And so once you start building up a sort of a compendium, you know, a sense of the weight of the way a particular writer uses a particular phrase, if somebody says, yes, most of the time that phrase means this, but in this instance it means something else, they have to be able to prove it means something else in this instance. In other words, there is not a book out there that uses Acts 2:42 as their evidentiary verse, as their proof text. There's not a one of them that offers the first bit of exegesis. Always, it's assumed. They just assume breaking bread means Lord's Supper. So if I can show you, which I will tonight, if I can show you three other passages where the same terminology is used and it's obvious from the context that it has nothing to do with the Lord's Supper, if I can prove that, then the weight of evidence, contextually, grammatically, is that what it means when it says breaking bread is they eat a meal together. Well, then if someone says, yes, but in this passage, it means Lord's Supper, the burden of proof is on them. They have to prove it means Lord's Supper. They can't assume it. It has to be proven. The problem is there's nothing in the text they can prove it with. So now let's look, rather than isolating it from its larger text, let's take a look at Acts 2:42 in the larger context. Let's start at verse 37. Now, this is right on the heels of Peter preaching the Pentecost sermon, the Holy Spirit falls and the church at Jerusalem is born. There haven't been Gentiles brought into the church yet. And Luke, who's writing the book of Acts, describes the community that grew out of that Pentecost sermon this way, starting at verse 37. Well, 36, and then you'll really understand what I just said about it being only Jews, only Israelites, because the sermon ended with, "Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made Jesus both Lord and Christ, and that is this Jesus who you crucified." Now, when they heard this, they were indeed pierced into their hearts, and they said to Peter and to the apostles' brethren, "What must we do?" Peter said to them, "Repent, and let each of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. For the promise is for you and for your children and all who are far off, as many as the Lord our God shall call to himself." And with many other words, he solemnly testified and kept on exhorting them, saying, "Be saved from this perverse generation." So then those who had received his word were baptized, and there were added that day about 3,000 souls, and they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to the breaking of bread and to prayer. And everyone kept feeling a sense of awe, and many wonders and signs were taking place through the apostles. And all those who had believed were together, and they had all things in common. And they began selling their property and their possessions, and they were sharing them with everyone, as anyone might have need. And day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord was adding to their number day by day those who were being saved. This is 50 days after Jesus kept the Passover and instituted what we know as the Lord's Supper. 50 days later, according to what Luke has written, there was this great outpouring of love for the saints among the saints. They sold what they had. They put all the money and all of their possessions into a community gathering, and they had a communal type of society among the Christians, and they shared everything they had. And even though verse 42 says they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and breaking bread, down in verse 46 it says that day by day they continued in the temple and breaking bread from house to house. So if you're going to argue that verse 42 establishes the Lord's Supper on a weekly basis, you have to be willing to say, actually, this passage establishes it daily, every day from house to house. Now, I just got done reading a book, and this is one of the places where they say not only that it establishes the weekly communion service, but that it also establishes that the Lord's Supper was taken with a full meal, and that it was normative in the first century church, and anybody not doing it that way is not following the apostolic teaching and tradition. Those are strong words. I mean, that's quite condemnatory of anybody not doing it. And yet, I kept waiting for the proof. You know, I kept waiting for the, and our evidence that we can say these kind of bold things is right here in the text. When they actually had to deal with the text of Acts 2, they actually said that the Lord's Supper weekly was normative as a result of this text, but the communal living and sharing everything was not. Yeah, that was my face. That's the face I made. I'm reading the book because I thought, okay, here is another great example of biblical inconsistency. If you're going to say that Acts 2 is normative and therefore binding on the conscience of the church even to this day, then the whole passage is binding. But they never even went to the day-by-day passages. They never went to the daily breaking bread. More importantly, pardon me? The sharing of the money, the houses, the product, the everything. Take everything you have, sell it, bring it to the church, we'll distribute it to anybody who has need. Yeah. That was the church secretary who just said woo to the idea of sell everything and bring the money to the church. Just want you to know that. She's the one who does all the accounting and handling of money for the church. She went up with woo. So just want you. Okay. But more importantly, look at verse 46 again, because Luke defines for us what the phrase breaking bread means. And this is why none of the books that quote Acts 2:42, none of them quote Acts 2:46. Because it says, and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness. So then, what does breaking bread mean in that context? Eating your meals, of course. That's why it's passed down into our language that way. We say it to this day, break bread together.
Is it meals or meat?
Pardon me?
Is it meals or meat?
Meat is an old English term that has to do with meals. It's the same idea. Taking your meat, taking your meal, it's the same idea. What it means is sitting down and eating together, right? But even more importantly, if we were going to go with meat, then breaking bread means eating meat, right? Here's the question then. You all have now looked at the text. We've talked about it. Can anybody offer, and this offer goes out to all the folks listening on the internet, please offer me your exegesis. Please prove to me from the text and not from assumption that Acts 2:42 must, not might be, must be referring to taking the Lord's Supper. Because if you're going to say that it's normative and binding on the conscience of the church today, then it can't be a maybe. It has to be a definite. So prove to me definitely from the text, exegetically, that breaking bread must mean Lord's Supper, because I can show you from only four verses later in verse 46 that Luke defines it as eating a meal, which is the way it's used in the rest of Luke's writing. Now the second verse that they all go to is Acts 20. So flip over there. And admittedly, this is the verse that is even more commonly used than Acts 2:42, because the wiser of the weekly, monthly advocates who go to the book of Acts recognize that verse 46 is a problem for them, so they'll kind of steer away from that occasionally. Some others will go ahead and quote it. The other thing they'll do is that they virtually never quote the verse. They'll just say, the first century church ate the Lord's Supper on a weekly basis in homes, and then in brackets after it, Acts 2:42. And then they just keep going. And if you take the time to look it up, then you can find out that it just doesn't say what they're claiming it says. Acts 20, verse 7, and usually combined with verse 11, oftentimes with an ellipsis between them. So I'm going to read it first with the ellipsis. This is the way it's normally quoted. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight, ... And when he had gone back up and had broken the bread and eaten, he talked with them a long while until daybreak, and so departed. Acts 20, verses 7 and 11. And then the argument goes, and in the book I was just referring to, this is exactly the argument. They'll say, this verse proves that it was normative for the first century church, as Paul traveled around establishing churches, for them to meet in homes on the first day of the week for the expressed purpose of taking the Lord's Supper. Because it says, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, therefore the purpose of their gathering, the reason they gathered, was they gathered together to take the Lord's Supper. And that's the leap. The question is, does the text say that? Of course, the text doesn't. And what's important to realize is that there are texts in the New Testament, like in the book of Corinthians that we'll look at next week, that actually do talk about the Lord's Supper. And Paul is going to lay out very specific information about the Lord's Supper, what you do during the Lord's Supper, how you treat the elements, and what it represents. So if Paul is capable and willing to be that specific about the Lord's Supper and how it can be taken rightly and wrongly, then it certainly seems incumbent on Luke at this moment. If what he is saying is that the normative practice of the church is to get together and take the Lord's Supper, it seems like that should actually be mentioned. It's not. Therefore, to impose it on the verse is egregious. Now let's look at what really happened in Acts 20 without the ellipsis and without the undue emphasis on the breaking bread part. Because the story is really about the fact that Paul's about to leave town. And since he's about to leave town, on the last night he's there, they gathered together to hear him preach. And he preached all night till daybreak. So get off my back. Starting at chapter 20, verse 1, after the uproar had ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he departed to go to Macedonia. And when he had gone through those districts and given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. And there he spent 3 months, and when a plot was formed against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return to Macedonia. And he was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, and by Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy, and Tychicus, and Trophimus of Asia. And they had gone on ahead, and they were waiting for us at Troas. And we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and we came to them at Troas within 5 days. The reason I started at the beginning is because in verse 6, Paul said something really, really important. He said these things took place after the days of unleavened bread, which means that even though Christ had already died, and even though this letter was probably written 30 years after the event, Paul's ministry takes place in that 20 to 30 year after the resurrection period, and yet they're still marking time by unleavened bread. Isn't that interesting? Notice all the way through the Old Testament and all the work we've been doing for the last several weeks about how they used Passovers to mark time. Here we are in the book of Acts, and look what he did again. And this was after the days of unleavened bread. They continue to mark time by Passovers. So Luke takes the time in verse 6 to say that these were the days of unleavened bread. And then we came to them at Troas within 5 days, and there we stayed for 7 days. So we're within 2 weeks of Passover and unleavened bread when this happens. And on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight, and there were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered together. If I just read it like I just did, and just let the words speak, what's the emphasis on that verse? What's the emphasis of that passage?
Paul preaching.
Paul preaching. It's about Paul traveling, going city to city, talking to different people, setting up churches. He gets to Troas, and he talks to them till midnight. That's the point. But he also tells us when and where. It happened after the days of unleavened bread, and it happened when they gathered together on the first day of the week because they got together to eat. So that tells us what time they got together. First day of the week, dinner time. And he talked till midnight. That gives you some idea how long he was talking. So the reference there to breaking bread, when we got together to break bread, just tells us what time of day this took place. But is there anything in that text that will force you, corner you? Remember earlier I was saying I like to be cornered? Is there anything in that verse that corners you into the inescapable conclusion that they got together for the express purpose of taking the Lord's Supper? No, it's just not there. But, like I said, the book that I've been making reference to said not only is this proof, it's normative and can be imposed on your conscience, that the Lord's Supper is a weekly thing that you've got to do or you're not following the apostolic tradition.
Or preach till midnight.
Or preaching till midnight, which is also now normative. I just want you to know that. So, you know, if you need something to eat, get it.
Oh, you can bring it back to life and I fall for it.
Well, that's the rest of it. So now look what happens. So there were many lamps in the upper room where they were gathered together. Which, by the way, I think, just as long as we're here in this passage, is a little bit of a clue. Why did he mention there were many lamps? I mean, it's night, you would know there would be lamps, right? They're oil lamps. Yeah, so the smoke is going up, and the gas is going up, and the air is going to be thinner up above where that's happening. So if you've got a guy sitting up in the third loft, and all that hot air is going up, the oxygen's getting thin. So there's a certain young man named Eutychus sitting in the windowsill, sinking into a deep sleep, and as Paul kept on talking, he was overcome by sleep, and he fell down from the third floor and he was picked up dead. But Paul went down and fell upon him, and after embracing him, he said, "Do not be troubled, for his life is in him." And when he had gone back up and had broken bread and eaten, he talked with them for a long while until daybreak, and so departed. There's your second reference to breaking bread here. And what is it? It's the man fell down dead. Paul got him back up and then put some food in him. Of course.
Had the Lord's Supper again.
Had the Lord's Supper again. Right. Because we'd already done it once. But immediately after death, you want to do it again. And we've reached the point where Larry is now become jovial about this. And he's actually chuckling about it because he sees the absurdity of the argument that says this must be the Lord's Supper. And not just this must be the Lord's Supper, but that it is now normative and imposed on your conscience if you're going to be truly apostolic. But what is that passage about?
That's okay to sleep while someone's preaching.
It's okay to sleep while someone's preaching. My work here is finished. Now, those are the two. Those are the two verses. Those are the two verses. Every book that makes the argument for weekly or monthly observance, those are their two verses. Are those convincing verses? No, that's a problem. So, the tacit assumption behind these verses is that any reference to breaking bread is necessarily a reference to the bread and wine communion ordinance. Acts 2:42 is cited to prove that immediately after Pentecost, the saints began the practice, and the verses from Acts 20 are employed to prove that it was part of their regular Sunday meetings. For instance, Arthur L. Farstadt, editor of the Journal of the Grace Evangelical Society, writes in his article entitled The Lord's Supper, "In the earliest days of the church, when believers were all together in Jerusalem, the disciples apparently broke bread every day, although some of these events may have been ordinary meals. By the time the church had progressed in its spread across the Roman Empire to many Gentile areas, the frequency of celebration would seem to have become weekly." Quote, "The first day of the week when the disciples came together to break bread," Acts 20, verse 7. See how easily that's done? Yeah. Similarly, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia reads, under the heading The Lord's Supper, parenthesis, Eucharist, it says, "The celebration of the Eucharist was characteristic of the Pentecostal church," Acts 2:42. And then he just goes on talking, because the assumption is that what we just read out of Acts 2:42, that said they shared everything in common and they broke bread, that means they took the Lord's Supper. "And it was especially taken on the Lord's Day," Acts 20, verse 7. "Its observance was preceded by the agape on the eve, for the circumstances of the institution were closely imitated, and the day was reckoned at sunset after the Jewish fashion, and thus the Eucharist proper came late into the night or toward the morning," according to Acts 20, verse 11. Now, we just read Acts 20. Did it establish anything that the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says it established? Even John Calvin defended the weekly Lord's Supper ritual by writing in his Institutes. In 417:44, he wrote, "That such was the practice of the apostolic church, we are informed by Luke in the book of Acts, when he says that they, quote, continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, and in the breaking of bread and in prayers," Acts 2:42. "Thus we ought always to provide that no meeting of the church is held without the word, the prayer, and the dispensation of the Lord's Supper." See how that works? The assumption is imposed onto the text. But the text, as we just clearly saw, simply doesn't support the assumption. So it can't be done exegetically. Remember I told you nobody's going to give you exegesis? They're just going to quote it and run? One more. The notion that references to breaking bread in the book of Acts necessarily refer to observing the Lord's Supper are replete in the standard literature on the subject. And as we might expect, Church of Christ literature is utterly reliant on it. For instance, on their official website, under the heading, "How often is the Lord's Supper to be eaten?" we read, "It is expected that every member of the church will assemble for worship on each Lord's Day. A central part of the worship is the eating of the Lord's Supper," Acts 20, verse 7. Unless providentially hindered, each member considers this weekly appointment as binding. In many instances, as in the case of illness, the Lord's Supper is carried to those who are hindered from attending the worship. Was there any evidence offered? No, just the assumption and the quoting of the text. And then you just hit it and run, because you can't do exegesis. These are the bedrock texts on which the advocates of the weekly, monthly Lord's Supper service build their case. Other than an occasional reference to 1 Corinthians 11:26, which we'll get to next week, there are typically no other texts they point to in order to bolster their assertions. It all stands or falls on Luke's writing in the book of Acts. So what if it can be proven that their assumption is incorrect? What happens to the necessity of the weekly, monthly schedule if their reading of Luke is based on a presumed outcome rather than on rigorous exegesis? The simple fact is that evidence for defining breaking bread as observing the Lord's Supper is tenuous at best. Acts 2:42 is not an orphan verse. It sits in the middle of a sweeping narrative describing the events that occurred on the heels of Pentecost. And then we just read it. The term breaking bread appears twice in this passage. The context has to do with community and sharing among the newly converted Jewish Christians at Jerusalem. In the first reference to breaking bread in verse 42, it was part of their fellowship. There's no reference to commemorating Christ's body and blood. And in the second reference to breaking bread in verse 46, it includes the parallel phrase, taking their meals together. And that is precisely what Luke intended to convey when he employed the term breaking bread. He was talking about eating regular meals. This is not uncommon parlance even today. We often speak of breaking bread with our family and friends, and we don't mean take the Lord's Supper. Luke's emphasis in this entire passage is on the unity and the sharing that mark the Pentecost church, and not a word is spoken of commemorating Christ's death, which is the important part of the Lord's Supper. I fear that the reason that the vast majority of the books, articles, and sermons arguing for the weekly or monthly communion limit their reference of this passage to verse 42 is that the balance of the passage undermines their argument. So, okay, we're going to skip forward in this article, because then I dealt with Acts 20, verse 11. Book of Acts, chapter 27, turn there. Let's look at more places where Luke talks about breaking bread. Same author is going to use the same phrase, same book. If in chapter 2 and chapter 20, the phrase breaking bread must mean Lord's Supper, what do we do about the fact that later Luke uses the phrase breaking bread in a context that has nothing clearly to do with the Lord's Supper? What do we do then? What do we do? What do we do? Well, what we do is we recognize that language means things, words mean things. And that, in fact, when Luke employed the term breaking bread, he was specifically referring to eating food. And then we have to take that reality back into chapter 2 and chapter 20 with us. Chapter 27, starting at verse 32, this is when Paul is shipwrecked. Starting at verse 32, then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat, and they let it fall away. And until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from your head of any of you shall perish. And having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. Does that have anything to do with the Lord's Supper?
Nothing at all.
No. Did Luke, in the same book, just say that Paul took bread, blessed it, and broke it? Same language that we see earlier. And yet in this context, it's clear it has nothing to do with the Lord's Supper. Well, then what does that tell us about how Luke uses the language of breaking bread? It has to do with eating food. The reason that this passage is an integral part of our study is that it was written by Luke, included in the same book as the earlier references, and it tells of Paul giving thanks and breaking bread. But the context is inarguable. Paul was insisting that starving men should take some food and eat, and it has nothing to do with observing the Lord's Supper, and the event included believers and heathens. The simple, plain, and clear fact is that there is no textual reason or imperative to assume that any of Luke's references to breaking bread are describing a communion service or a memorial to Christ's death. If they were weekly or, in chapter 2, day by day, memorials to Christ's death, it seems like Luke would have mentioned that. Because the church had just been established. If they were every day getting together and taking the Lord's Supper, it seems like Luke would want to point that out because this letter was going to Theophilus, a Greek, to help him understand how the church should function. There's not a mention of it, not a word. To make the point more emphatically, let's look at one other reference to bread breaking from Luke's pen. In Luke's gospel, turn over to the Gospel of Luke. Because if we can comfortably conclude that the Bible writers use the phrase breaking bread as little more than a colloquialism for eating a meal, then the primary basis on which the weekly, monthly advocates build their argument tumbles down like the proverbial house of cards. In Luke 24, we read of Christ joining his disciples as they walk on the Emmaus Road. He hid his identity from them as he taught them about himself from Moses and the prophets. Luke 24, starting at verse 28, says, "And they approached the village where they were going, and he acted as though he would go further. And they urged him, saying, 'Stay with us, for it is getting toward evening, and the day is now nearly over.' And he went in to stay with them. And it came about that when he had reclined at the table with them, he took bread and blessed it, and breaking it, he began giving it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. And they said to one another, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was speaking to us on the road, while he was explaining the scriptures to us?' And they arose that very hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found gathered together the 11 and those who were with them, saying, 'The Lord has really risen and has appeared to Simon.' And they began to relate their experiences on the road and how he was recognized by them in the breaking of bread." Still Luke writing. When Luke writes this, is he describing Jesus having the Lord's Supper with him? Now, this is really, really important because remember, this is taking place right after Jesus has instituted the Lord's Supper and has gone and died. This is during the period between his resurrection and Pentecost. So if he is breaking bread at this moment to institute the Lord's Supper, we've got a whole lot of theological baggage we've got to talk about. You know, Pentecost hasn't happened. The church hasn't even been formed yet. And here he is taking the Lord's Supper with them yet again. So nobody argues that this passage from Luke is about the Lord's Supper. No one argues. And yet, it's still Luke using the exact same language about breaking bread. So my point is this. If you're really going to do Bible study and word study and grammatical study, the best way to understand word usage is to see how the author uses a word. For instance, John 3:16. "For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that all that believed on him would not perish but have everlasting life." John later will write in one of his short epistles, "Brethren, do not love the world, neither the things that are in the world. If you love the world, the love of God is not in you." Wait a minute. Aren't you the same John who just said God so loved the world? But now you're telling us if we love the world, we don't have the love of God in us? So we're not supposed to love the world that God so loved. Well, that tells us that John's use of the word world has more than one meaning. Because you look at the way John as an author uses language in order to understand what John is saying. What we've done tonight is that we've looked at the way that Luke specifically uses the phrase breaking bread. And in the most obvious instances, we know it has nothing to do with the Lord's Supper. So when we look at the early Pentecost church or the church at Troas, the meeting at Troas in chapter 20, when Luke in passing says, "We got together to break bread," if you're going to say that it means Lord's Supper, you have to prove it. You can't just say it. You can't just assume it. You have to prove it exegetically. And that you can't do. And yet, the same people who can't do it are the very ones telling me I'm wrong. Saying, well, no, the weekly gathering for the full meal that includes the Lord's Supper, that's normative. If you're not doing it as a church, you are not following the apostolic tradition. I would argue They are not following the apostolic tradition. They are following the traditions of men by assuming meanings to the text that simply aren't in the text. Okay, let's look at one more example, then I'll let you go. Oh, you know what I did? Can anybody believe I did that? I cut off my notes. Hey, I only printed up to that page, because the article's really much longer than this.
Does Luke ever mention the Lord's Supper?
Very good question. It's a really good question. Does Luke ever mention the Lord's Supper? He does in his gospel, where he, just like the other synoptic writers, talk about the Passover supper they took together, and then very specific information about him taking the cup, and this is the cup of my blood in the New Testament, breaking the bread, this is my body given for you. He includes that information in his gospel, as does Matthew and Mark. So yes, he does mention the Lord's Supper, and he's very specific about what constitutes the Lord's Supper.
But does he call it the Lord's Supper?
No. Remember I told you last week, the phrase Lord's Supper only occurs once in the whole Bible. Okay. It occurs in 1 Corinthians when Paul makes that reference to it and calls it the Lord's Supper. But even then, when Paul refers to it, he uses it in contrast to those that were coming there and gorging themselves on food. And he says, you can't take the Lord's Supper. You're too busy taking your supper. Okay. So even then, the Lord's Supper doesn't become a title attached to that supper outside of the way we've just commonly gotten used to saying it. Know what I mean?
Right.
So, yes, sir.
Is it Mark 6:41?
Let's find out. Mark 6:41. It would be nice if it was. No, but you know that works. In Mark 6:41, he's feeding the 5,000. Mark writing says that he took 5 loaves and 2 fish, looking up toward heaven. He blessed the food and broke the loaves. So he's breaking bread. And then he kept giving that to the disciples, and everybody ate. So there's another breaking bread reference by another New Testament writer that has nothing to do with the Lord's Supper. But I think you see how easy this is to do now, right, Larry? Here's another one. Here's another reference. So as you start accumulating critical mass of how New Testament writers use the phrase breaking bread or make references to breaking bread, it always has to do with eating a meal. It always has to do with eating a meal. Always it has to do with eating a meal. If you're going to say, but not in Acts 2:42, then you have to say, okay, and your evidence is, and that's the question they can't answer. Have I kind of beat that point to death tonight? Do we get that point? Because if everything I just said tonight is true, and I have belabored the point so that nobody will misunderstand my position, but if those verses that refer to breaking bread actually mean eat a meal, which is what they have always meant and still means in common parlance, if that's true, then where is the evidence for the weekly or the monthly communion service? Where is it?
It's not there.
It's not there. It's just not there. So then the question becomes, where does that leave us?
Does that leave us with only doing it once a year?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about next week. Because if everything I said tonight is true, then what do we got? Do we got nothing?
Where does the tradition come from? I see that they found text to justify it, but that's
sure. You actually answered that question earlier when you said Catholic Church.
Right.
Mass.
Right.
Which they then just called the Eucharist, which means Thanksgiving.
Right.
Then suddenly you've got this regular every time that the Mass is performed, you have to eat the flesh of your God. You have to drink the blood of your God, because that's what the priests of Baal, the Kahana Baal, from which we get the word cannibal, that was already occurring in the Baal temples.
So when part of Constantine's.
Very much so. Okay. And so as you have that blending of ancient pagan religion,
right,
blending together with Roman Christianity, the same way that you get Christmas and Easter and rabbits, eggs, you also get every time the church gets together, we eat his flesh and drink his blood.
Oh, which is what the Catholics do every time?
Absolutely, yes. That's what Mass is. Mass is the gathering to do that very thing.
So they think it's literal, it's not just like a symbol.
Right, that's what transubstantiation is. It's the literal change. Yeah. In fact, since you asked, is it the literal body and blood that they eat? Yes, they believe it is, and you'll enjoy this. Here, you've sat here very patiently all night. I don't even know your name. What is your name?
Zach.
Zach? Okay. You've sat here very patiently, and I don't know if you've learned anything tonight, but here's something you can take with you to school tomorrow and impress your friends. Do you know where the term hocus pocus comes from? When you do magic tricks? Hey, watch, hocus pocus. Hey, boo. Do you know where that phrase comes from? It comes from the priests who used to say in Latin, hocus corpus meus, which means this is my body. And when they would say that, the bread would become the literal body of Christ. So it was a magic trick. And so the critics of the Catholic priests used to make fun of them in the way that they would say hocus corpus meus and make things happen. So they would say hocus pocus on them. And that just moved into our language as hocus pocus, do a magic trick. So there, hey. See, the Bible's fun. The Bible's so full of fun stuff. All right. All that being said, where does it leave us? Do we have no standards on how often we ought to take the communion? Next week, I am going to argue out of the Corinthian letter and not just out of 1 Corinthians 11, which is what everybody isolates and says it's just right here and therefore I can make it say whatever I want it to say, but from the whole of the letter and the context of the letter, I am going to show you and prove to you that Paul is still counting Passovers and he's going to place the Lord's Supper. The only place in the whole Bible where the term Lord's Supper is used is placed in the context of do this yearly. And that's when I became convinced.
And Jesus also said.
And Jesus saying,
Do this in remembrance of me,
in remembrance of my death. I mean, it's funny that we understand the concept of memorializing. Like, Zach, how many birthdays a year you get?
One.
One, yeah, see, every year, once
well,
a year.
Once you're born on a leap year, then it's
four. Yeah. But you don't age as quick, and I could have used that. Yeah, because we understand that concept. In fact, on our American calendar every year, we even have a day called Memorial Day because we understand the concept of you memorialize things on an annual basis. Jesus said that this supper, this memorial that took place on Passover was now going to be a memorial of his death. And Paul's going to pick it up in the Corinthian letter and validate on the same night he did it is the night that we do it because that's how we memorialize his death that happened yearly. Because, remember what I keep saying, when did Passover happen? Once a year. Every year they had to stop and memorialize it. God started marking that 430 years before the deliverance. God kept marking that day forever. Now that the Christian church and the inception of the Christian church has happened, that day continues to be marked. It's been marked throughout history. Only now it's being marked as the memorial of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. Someone will say to me then, but what about the new covenant? Jim, you're a new covenant guy. What about the new covenant? And what about the fact that Paul wrote, don't let any man judge you in the keeping of new moons and Sabbaths and feasts? We'll deal with that too. Because it's all part and parcel of what we have to be able to address in order to establish the once a year commemoration of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. So I know that argument's out there. Save the time. Don't write me the email. I know. I understand that that's something that has to be addressed. We'll address that too. In the meantime, all you weekly, monthly folk out there who are continuing to use those Acts 2 and Acts 20 arguments, send me your exegesis. Fair enough?
Yep.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.